Bow, chicka, bow, bow.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the A Dime Bad Podcast. I'm Tyler Wilkinson. We're joined today by our writers. We have Russ Steinberg.
Hello.
And Megan Bard.
Hello.
And Big Meech, Kevin Meacham. He's not going to say hello to you. He doesn't even care. This is how little he cares about this right now.
Can you not hear me?
Now I can.
Oh, okay. Well, I said, what's up?
Yeah. The silence fits the brand better. And we have our podcast producer, Alex Cullen.
Hello, hello.
So, this is miraculous that we're doing this podcast, considering we just did a podcast like within the last 2 weeks. Was it last week?
Like a week and a half ago, yeah.
So this is downright incredible. But some cool stuff has actually happened in UConn world since then. So after our last like wholly depressing shit show podcast, we thought we might actually provide you with some uplifting content, starting probably with the UConn men with their first winning streak of the year against Division I teams. So that's pretty badass, right?
Woo!
Yeah.
You're saying Boston University is not a Division I team?
Syracuse is actually not the Division I team in this case.
Oh,
as far as I know, there aren't any Division I schools located outside of America. But I don't know. You guys are like the experts, so I'll defer.
It's not just a winning streak, though. They look much more like a cohesive unit as a team. They have much more of a plan, and they have some certain players who are just really stepping up, and the one to point out is certainly Kenton Facey. He's been absolutely tremendous.
Oh, look, when you actually get your bigs involved and they do offense things, you win games. It's crazy. It's a crazy thing.
It's amazing how even two relatively inconsequential wins in the scope of the season can just sort of change the whole mood around the program. I'm certainly feeling better if, you know, while I'm still maintaining my constant UConn athletics pessimism now that I've embraced, but I feel better.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Now, they're 2-3 in the conference. And I know it's early to look at the standings, but if you look at all the teams below UConn currently, if UConn beats all of them every time they play, they'll finish 9-9 in the conference, which is perfectly good enough to put yourself in a position where you're going into Hartford and you can manageably win three games. So, you know, only two wins, it doesn't do a whole lot, but first of all, it shows that you can win games, which we didn't know was a thing. And it puts UConn in the position where if it can beat the teams that it should, you know, they have a shot.
They certainly looked better. I mean, it wasn't even just that, like, oh, they, like, snuck out a couple of wins. Like, they looked like a team that knew how to play basketball, particularly against Temple. I thought the defense was really good. And Vance also coming up, actually looking like somebody who can be relied on to take shots and not just threes, which was really nice to see also.
The big thing, I think, is that it seemed like they've been working a lot harder to get better shots.
Right.
Shooting threes in rhythm, it's not, you know, Adams firing a three at the end of the shot clock. It's not Purvis, you know, firing a three at the end of the shot clock. They're getting good looks, open looks, off penetration, and it's you know, making the offense look like a real offense. You know, the defense has always been pretty much there. If this is for real, and if Vance can keep scoring, you know, at the rate he's scoring, if Facey can be that post presence who can score, then, you know, there's a lot to be optimistic about for the rest of the season.
Yeah, you know, their defense has been good most of the way, but I think it took a step up for a lot of that game against Temple. Their man-to-man most of the game was spectacular, and even when they switched into that zone, they did a great job of closing out on shooters, not giving up too many open looks from three, which had been a problem before, even when UConn was just getting lucky and the other team was missing them all. I think they were cohesive defensively, especially against Temple.
They definitely were, and the, like, there you saw a lot fewer missed rotations. I mean, especially when you have a bunch of freshmen in there, that happens a lot more. I like them starting out in the press. I think that really helps their game. Also the Brima lobs to start halves. But I think I am a huge, huge fan of coming out in the press, and I just want to commend KM for that decision.
And on the other end, it looked like UConn, for the most part, did a pretty good job breaking the Temple press. And it wasn't overly reliant on their somewhat suspect ball handlers. It was having an actual plan to get the ball up the court, you know, nice sharp passes, and not really giving Temple enough time to really trap them in the backcourt.
Yeah.
They put either Facey or Jackson right at half court every time they got pressed. So it was a, and that's how they got the ball up as quickly. I mean, you put a tall guy who can catch the ball in the middle of the floor. It worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
No. It, you could tell this was like a thing that they'd practice. This is what you're going to do when you get pressed.
See, and there's my takeaway. My oversimplified thing I like best about the last two games is for the first time this season, I felt like I was certain they practiced beforehand. Where they have just been so amazingly unprepared to start games all year. And sometimes they could fight their way back into it or whatever. But they've really come out, and you could tell that there's a strategy associated with the game, and they're actually executing it. They're coming out focused from the tip against UCF, quite literally, when Kenton Vasey beat Taco Fall for the tip, because Taco Fall was like asleep, probably because he's very tired from being a giant human.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
And then again, as Megan points out, you know, starting each game with a press, and then it seems like they go to zone when they really are trying to just steal some rest. And Kevin's always been, for all of his substitution methods that drive me a little crazy at times, he's always been relatively adept at stealing his star guards a little bit of rest right before TV timeouts. He's doing a pretty good job this year, and especially in the last two games, of finding ways to make up for this depleted roster by stealing a little bit of rest in the zone, the same way he's stealing rest, you know, getting Jalen to play 37 minutes instead of 40. You know, it's something at least.
How glad are we all that Perv spent the entire offseason getting fit as fuck?
Every single year we hear announcers being like, I don't know, this UConn team's going to get tired. And it's like, attend to practice. These guys will not get tired.
Perv and Adams are basically playing 40 minutes a game. I would die. I would be dead. I would not be alive if I did that.
Tyler, you said you brought up an interesting point where you said it looks like they practiced, but you got to take it a step further. It looks like they actually prepared for the opponents that they were playing in their two games. They looked like they had a perfect plan for Central Florida and a perfect plan for Temple. It looked like they really disrupted them in exactly the things that those two teams do well.
Especially on the Temple side, you know, UConn beat Temple in the AAC tournament last year, but before then, I think they had lost like four straight times to them. Fran Duffy was out coaching Kevin often, very obviously. So,
and it really seemed like this time Kevin knew how to prepare for Fran Duffy's team.
And I'm genuinely curious, and I doubt we'll ever know this, if something changed, you know, with Kevin and with the staff, you know, is someone else doing the pregame preparation now? You know, I don't know who did before. Did duty shift? You know, I have a lot of questions that we'll probably never know the answers to, but something has changed either in the coaching responsibilities or just in the general focus of the players. And they really do look like an entirely different team right now. Of course, that could all be, we're recording this on Friday night. So by the time some people hear this after they play Georgetown, they come out flat, and that one will be eating our words and look like idiots. It's just kind of on brand.
And a key thing to remember is you know, it is two games, and you know, they're shooting very well the last two games. A lot of that is because of the shot selection, because they're working to get the better shots. But you know, we certainly don't have overwhelming talent and numbers with the injuries we have this year. You know, we shot 52% for the game against Temple. We were something like 6 for 9 from three against UCF in the first half. When shots fall, we're going to look good.
Kind of going off of what Tyler said a minute ago, something had to have changed within the team. When you look at the Memphis game, which was their last loss. I mean, you had, who was it, Adams and Purvis yelling at each other.
Yeah.
Looked like they kind of quit during that game.
Never a good look.
No. And then you have this game against Temple, a solid team, where UConn builds, I think it was a 17-point lead, gets it into single digits, and you would have expected that same UConn team that we saw against Memphis to fold at that point and to let Temple, you know, keep getting closer, and eventually probably win the game. And it just didn't happen. Every time Temple made a run, UConn was at least able to stop the bleeding when it needed to. And I thought that was very impressive.
It's funny how
they got to the free throw line more. They took more free throw shots. They made their free throws. There was probably another, like, 10 points that we have not been seeing throughout the season. And I mean, as we were saying, more high percentage shots. They took fewer threes in the Temple game even than they took in the USF game, which I feel like this offense is going to be the most productive when they're taking fewer overall three-point shots.
When they take fewer, they're going to end up making more, because when you're going inside to Fenton Casey, who's playing so well, and you're getting opportunities then to kick it back out, and you're taking higher percentage three-point looks.
I got to say, I mean, I'm not looking at the numbers right now, but I just don't think anybody in this conference is good enough to where we can't say that UConn can't still finish in the top four.
Yeah, they can't. They won't catch Cincinnati, SMU, and Houston. But is UCF, like, does UCF look like a team that's going to go 12-6, 13-5?
Not to me.
UCF's not going to sustain it. Tulsa's dog shit, even though they beat us. Temple is 1-4, so even though they beat some good teams, you can still finish ahead of them, especially if we win at Temple.
And UCF.
So I think it's very
doable. UCF's three conference wins are a little bit of an illusion, too, because it was Temple at home and then Tulane in East Carolina.
I'm looking at Pomeroy right now. He's got Cincinnati 16-2, SMU 14-4, Houston 13-5 projections. And then he's got UCF and Memphis at 10-8, Tulsa 9-8, or 9-9. And UConn and Temple at 8-10. So it's close.
If we buy pretty hard that the last two games are indicative of some level of consistency that the team can have, I'd say that those projections are going to change quickly. I think I do buy it. I see a change in the team. I do. And I know it's only two games, and I know it's, you know, you never can tell with these kinds of things, but there's a certain amount that you can only see when you watch the team, and there does seem to be an emotional lift there.
At the end of January, I think UConn's going to be ahead of ECU almost regardless. I mean, not ECU, UCF.
So I posted on my Facebook that I bought the Ray Allen jersey, and my friend just wrote, I want a Suleiman Juan.
Call Muncy.
Absolutely. Give me my Muncy Hardnet.
You stole the joke from my mouth.
I mean, why? Where's the Ricky Mark Kevin Freeman? Obviously, those should be next. They're right there. Like,
well, that's why
right
I want
to
know how many they have to sell to break even. Because legitimately, how many Ricky Moore jerseys are people going to buy? I know Megan will buy like a carton.
I would buy the Ricky Moore jersey.
All right, should we change gears?
Do we want to talk about the core four conundrum?
Sure.
Yeah.
Set it up here, Megan. What are we talking about?
Okay, so today we were talking about what to call the group of women's basketball players, Nafisa Collier, Katie Samuelson, Gabby Williams, Kia Nurse, which some people have, for reasons passing understanding, started calling the core four, which is already a thing if you are a Yankee fan, and as many UConn fans are, we feel like it's just not okay. So we were brainstorming a few other ideas, because apparently you have to name them.
Right. And they all need to have some sort of reference to the number four for some reason.
The four Husketeers.
And actually Meech contributed Husketeers, which is awful. The four Husketeers.
the four Huskies of the Apocalypse.
Russ just wrote a lot of
Foreign Legion.
Russell Steinberg presents the four.
Mm-hmm.
Oh god.
Grant Balfour, the team. That was Meech's.
Quality Quartet.
Par four.
The ones that aren't Natalie Butler.
Yeah, that was UConn, that was my submission.
I didn't see that the first time.
UConnect, the formal title.
UConnect four.
Okay. Four players who maybe individually aren't the best in the country, but as a team, they're pretty good. That was from Meech, or as he abbreviated it, FPWMIATBITCBAATTGP.
Think it's going to catch on.
PG. Man. Yeah, no, it rolls off the tongue.
Formula One with a W.
Hmm.
So bad.
That's I tried
so
to go
bad. So bad.
With
I love it.
The French
so
and Indian horrible. Four. Someone else said World 4-2. I think the Four of the Roses.
Four of the Roses.
Four of the Roses.
The Peloponnesian Four.
That doesn't even make sense. Like that one doesn't even make sense.
Gino Fauriemma.
Hmm. The Fourth Estate. The Fourth Wall. Four Dog Night. So we actually had two actual ones that are not awful, right? Is that our consensus?
That's stretching the definition, but yeah.
The first of which was Formation, right? Spelled with F-O-U-R, Mation. They sound awful when you say them out loud, which is probably not a great sign.
You can tell we're all, like, Twitter people and writers, because, like, in person and over voice, it just sounds terrible.
This is terrible, yeah. Although Core 4 still sounds terrible. We're all
Twitter people. The Four Husketeers sounds great.
No. No, it doesn't. It does not.
I would love to see it memorialized in print. Is Jacobs listening to this podcast? If he is, it'll be there. So the other one was, it was Squad, but with the Q capitalized for quad, which took me an embarrassingly long time to figure out.
Just because, you know, I know who our readers and listeners are. Quad usually refers to something in a group of four.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to emphasize the Q for to make that work when you say it?
Squad. No, I feel like you just say squad.
It's a quad.
It's a squad.
They could take my...
There's lots of hashtag possibilities. You got squad goals, things of that nature.
Maybe let's just not call them anything. Cool. Why do we need to call things?
I mean, we didn't have a name for Brianna Stewart, Mariah Jefferson, Morgan Tuck, though we have the top five for the guys. So, like, I don't know. Maybe we need gender parity on names.
Three of them blew out their knees and we stopped that pretty damn quick.
Maybe we shouldn't name them. Maybe we shouldn't do that.
Yeah, like, it's not working. It's not working.
The top five are getting injured.
Right. The top five is what I call the team of surgeons that's putting our basketball team back together. The UConn Health Center, top five. Shout.
Quadrilateral.
Quadrilateral.
Again, we're doing this on Friday night, so tomorrow the women go for their 91st consecutive win, setting their own record.
Yep.
And we can comfortably report that they
have pasted
SMU.
Yeah, we don't even need to timestamp this. It happened. They won. We all celebrated. Seeing Gino naked on national TV was weird, but not unpleasant. It was an unexpected way for him to celebrate, but you know.
Meacham, what are the odds that at some point the rest of the season, UConn holds a team to single digits?
Honestly, it might be pretty good. If they're going to hold USF to 37, there's going to be one game where like a team is just not shooting well and they get blocked.
Who's the worst team? I'll say teens,
but I'm not going to say single digits.
I think someone will be in the 20s.
Oh, we've seen UConn do that before.
Yeah.
I mean, the AAC is bad, man. It's bad.
So bad.
It's really bad.
I think Tulsa's the worst team. Tulsa's 5-11 this year. You know what's going to be interesting? This is a little morbid, I guess, but so they play South Carolina on February 13th. If they lose, the next game is Tulane. If they lose that game, how bad do you think they're going to fuck up Tulane?
That might be your single digit opportunity.
Right. Yeah. Tulane will cease to exist as a recognized entity after Gino storms in there naked and burns their campus to the ground. Should we do an instant mailbag?
Yeah.
So every Friday we do the Dimeback mailbag. We answer three of your questions at least. Usually they're awful, but we improve them with our insight via the answers. So we solicited some for the recording of this podcast, and I'm going to ask one because it's topical from Stores South, who is at UConn 6th Borough, who asks thoughts on moving the football game against Boston College. So for a little background, UConn had a home game scheduled with Boston College that was supposed to be played at the Rent. They have now moved it to Fenway Park, which is somewhere in South New Hampshire, to the best of my understanding. And it will still count as a UConn home game despite being played in Boston. Thoughts?
Sucks.
It sucks. But, and it's so sad because it's I said this to you guys in the Slack. This is the formerly rich family that's selling off the silver to survive. And like, I get it, but I'm a season ticket holder and like, I wanted to go to that game in East Hartford. And like, Fenway is a shitty football venue.
So we should note that UConn is getting $1.125 million for doing this. And that's the biggest guarantee they've ever received.
So I know UConn's getting a substantially larger block of tickets than Boston College. And then the Fenway management group will be given a nice chunk as well.
Okay. So UConn gets 22,000, BC is getting 7,000, and Fenway's getting 10,000.
There you go. In which case, UConn's going to make a lot of money. I mean, yeah, it's awful, and I genuinely do feel bad.
It's going to pay for a chunk of the buyout.
I do feel bad for season ticket holders, but there are not enough of you to matter. And I say that with a little bit of affection. But if UConn had 30,000 season ticket holders, this would not have happened. They need money because they don't have season ticket holders, so they're not afraid of offending you. And I understand why that's awful.
It's hard too, because the catch 22 there is that, like, if you're known to treat your season ticket holders like shit, you're not going to encourage people to be season ticket holders.
Oh yeah, no, there's no reason to be a UConn season ticket holder, as far as I'm concerned. I wouldn't do it. God bless you, Megan. I think you're the only season ticket holder here.
Honestly, if it wasn't for the like group of people I go with and we like have a blast, it would probably not be a thing I do. But it's like my college buddies and we have a good time.
Yeah, and I mean it's funny just because UConn for decades, at least a decade, has just been awful generally, especially to students, but to ticket holders sort of in a larger scope. They'd never make things easier for ticket holders ever. And they rarely improve on things. And it's funny that there was an emphasis of when Benedict came in and he's talked a lot about game day experience, talked a lot about hiring consultants, and then they played so incredibly poorly that no one, no matter what they did, no one would go to a game. So it is sort of ironic that right when they seem to be somewhat committed, they now need to start doing all these gimmicks just to be financially solvent. But from the outside, I mean, they need to be financially solvent. I think it's a no-brainer decision. They need the money more than they need to appease season ticket holders, because if they can improve the program, people will come back. And it's awful. Yeah, I would be horribly pissed if I was a season ticket holder. But just from a numbers, a dollars and cents perspective, they have to do it.
Yeah, and if you're a season ticket holder and you're upset, and procreate, like make more of you.
I mean, the other thing is this does kind of protect UConn in the event that the team is shitty because Bob Diaco left the roster bare, you know, even though he had to rebuild the program from scratch, according to a source.
According to sources.
According to sources.
But
well, one source. Time.
UConn goes into that game at 2-7. You know, they're getting maybe half full with BC fans and 20,000 people at the rent. They don't get, they're getting more money and guaranteed money that protects them in the event that the team is just awful again.
Yeah, I mean, because it's not like we could have relied at Rentschler on BC turning out, because they can't even get people to their own stadium.
Yeah, Megan, what was the turnout at the UConn BC game this year?
It was pretty low, I will say. It was fairly low. I mean, there was a decent number of UConn fans. I mean, it was more BC than UConn, but like not by a huge margin. I think there's a lot of like UConn grads in Boston, and if you live in Boston and you went to UConn, you're from Connecticut, you're going to go to that game. So I was surprised actually at the number of UConn shirts I saw. So if they're new OC has them playing football we actually like want to watch, and it could work. Like, I'm not saying it won't work. It just sucks for me.
Right.
It's a $1 million insurance policy, basically, because the chances of the team being good are not that great. I think we'll probably sell out most of, if not all of, the 22,000 allotment because it's a novelty, whereas it's not a novelty to see two bad teams playing at Rensselaer Field. We're in the AAC. We make $3 million a year on TV. We need every source of money we can find. You know, it's not good, but it is what it is.
So we got to talk about the excellent news this week about our offensive coordinator hire. I mean, I can say that from my perspective, you know, as kind of a...
Oh, I'm sorry, Alex. Breaking news. UConn has named a defensive coordinator.
Oh, what?
Waterford native, current Villanova defensive coordinator, Billy Crocker.
All right.
Okay. I do not know a thing about that person.
All right.
Villanova's good.
I mean, we can pretty much assume that he's going to be training under Edsel as a defensive coordinator, right? I mean, Edsel's really going to be steering the ship defensively, I would think.
Yeah, Edsel does. Edsel has always been more of a defensive coach.
Last season, Crocker's defense gave up 18 points per game, which ranks second in the CAA and 11th nationally. They also ranked second in total defense at 309 yards per game in the CAA, 16th nationally.
Cool.
Yep. All right.
Seems okay.
All right.
Seems perfectly Cromulan.
Villanova did give up fewer points to Pitt than Clemson did.
There you go.
So our defense is now better than Clemson.
You know what? I've never heard of them before this moment, but, and here we can segue back right now, is I feel like Benedict, especially, and Etzel, to whatever degree he's involved, have earned the latitude to make the hire they deem appropriate for that position, because we got what we wanted out of their offensive coordinator hire.
So I went from thinking that I went from like a lot of you were, I went from worrying that Benedict was just shooting from the hip and going for a safe pick so that he could get out of here in a couple of years, to thinking, oh, this was a really shrewd move, because he must have had Lashley in his back pocket before he even went for Edsel.
Let's pull the room. Which decision do you think was made first by Benedict? The decision to hire Randy Edsel or the decision to hire Rhett Lashley?
Well, was there, am I making this up or reading a Boneyard fever dream, or was there a report that he had reached out to donors about Lashley making him the head coach and they said they wanted Edsel? Am I making that up?
I do not know, but that would make sense. I know we heard Lashley's name amongst candidates the same time we were all having our own fever dreams about Joe Moorhead.
Which, I mean, wouldn't it all surprise me if for the Diaco buyout was contingent on getting Edsel? And, you know, if he somehow managed to convince Lashley to come here with the assumption that, I mean, he's going to get to run his own offense, but also that in 3 to 5 years he's going to be the coach here, like,
yeah,
I'd be surprised if that was the deal on the table.
But that still doesn't quite add up to me, because Lashley was in the discussion to get this job anyway. So if he had stayed at Auburn in that time anyway, coached at a higher profile school, had more success, he would have gotten a chance to be the head coach somewhere anyway. So why cut your salary in half to go to UConn?
Well, some of it has to do with the situation at Auburn. Malzahn seems to be on the hot seat. They score 30 points a game, which sounds great to us, but when you're 8-5 in the SEC, you know, you want the greatest possible offense. So I think Malzahn was a little bit on the hot seat, and if there was going to be a scapegoat, you know, it was probably going to be a guy like Lashley, who has been attached to Malzahn's hip. And so the idea being, you know, if we're going to have to let you go, you've got a soft landing spot. You know, $350,000 is better than zero. That would make sense. I don't know if that's entirely the case, but that would be.
But he
could.
I mean, he does have the relationship with Benedict. So, and I assume that there's other incentives on the table. I know there's been discussion with the contract of these additional incentives. We don't know what they are yet because they haven't been spelled out. But
I mean, what this really underscores to me too is just how little leverage Randy Edsel had in this negotiation, because you know for a fact now that in addition to taking that low base salary, he was told that this was not his decision. You know, like, regardless of the timing of when they decided Lashley was going to be working for UConn, it was not Randy Edsel who made that decision, and I am 100% certain of that.
This was the hire they had to nail.
Right.
I mean, other than the head coach, and I don't know how much of an actual search there was for the head coach. Certainly, it looks good right now.
I mean, it certainly makes the Edsel hire feel a lot more strategic, as from every angle, whether it's having a built-in replacement, you know, almost like a line of succession built into the coaching staff, or putting Benedict more at the helm of creating the product he needs to sell. I mean, there's a lot of moving pieces here that were clearly not visible to us at the time Edsel was hired, that is making the hiring of Edsel itself look a lot more shrewd, especially with the renewed enthusiasm of the donor base built into it as well, which was, I mean, to be honest, as equally as important as whatever product they end up putting on the field.
Also, I mean, just from what I can gather from some of the donors that I know, I know a couple of the larger donors, and they're very tight-lipped about things, but they did know all of this was happening when it was happening. They were informed, and I would imagine they were part of the process of making the decision. Kind of moving forward a little bit, now that we have our OC and we know kind of what his resume is and what he's capable of, one of the big questions now is, can he get a real quarterback to UConn?
Yeah, that's good. That's going to be the question. I was listening to a radio interview that he was doing in, I think, Arkansas. That's where he's from. You know, talking about how fundamentally everything rides on your quarterback. If you have a good quarterback, you can do a lot more, you know, basic stuff, but it does feel like that will be a priority for him.
Sounds like a smart guy.
It does seem like a situation where if he doesn't think that Donovan Williams is the guy, and last year indicates that, that he would be pushing for someone that they can go out and get.
Is Bryant Sheriff that quarterback?
As a one-year stopgap, maybe.
So we talked about...
He can win 5-6 games this year.
Do you guys think Sheriff comes back?
I'm at like 40, he does. 60, he doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, he's gotten the shit beaten out of him at UConn because he hasn't had an O-line to play behind his entire time, and he learned how to slide in like week 8 of this past season.
It was so amazing watching the championship game on Monday and watching a competent line actually protect their quarterback.
It was weird.
It was the weirdest thing.
I also was watching Alabama's defense in the first half thinking, oh my God, Sheriffs would literally be dead on the field. And this is out in the open, right? So that we know Sheriffs has a kid on the way. His girlfriend is Prego.
Fiance.
Yeah.
Tyler, it's his fiance.
And he's never going to play professionally. I don't know. I don't think he comes back. You got a kid on the way. You're a college graduate. At best, you have...
Get the free masters.
At best, you have 12 games left, like, in your career. Do you really want to risk, throwing your brain out there to get smashed into cottage cheese?
I put it at 30% he comes back.
That's where I'm at.
I love the optimism in thinking that this kid who committed to Auburn might decommit and come here. I love the optimism. Someone who is capable of playing at Auburn is not going to come to UConn.
Dan Orlovsky, a fake mustache.
I'm very, very happy to have a man that quarterbacks love now working for UConn.
Flyers apparently love Diaco too, according to sources.
Sources have told us via the Lincoln Journal Sentinel. All right. Anything else we need to talk about?
Hockey?
They just beat Maine yesterday. They're playing in Fenway Park tomorrow.
Which will have happened by, well, maybe not, depending on what time I get this to air. On Saturday, they play Fenway Park.
Yes. I believe they gave up a home game and are being paid $1 million to play a hockey game.
That's the new business model.
That's fine. Can we play basketball games there, too?
I think so, yeah. Right now they're on track for a 5 or 6 seed in Hockey East, which would be phenomenal. Last year they got their first home first-round series. They finished 8th, and probably they're going to be better next year, assuming they don't have too many people leave for the NHL. Yeah, they're fun to watch. Go to Hartford, watch them.
As long as it's fun to watch, I'm good.
Go watch some Ice Bus. That's our tip. Do not buy football season tickets and go watch Ice Bus. I think those are our takeaways.
Buy football tickets.
Right. Just don't buy. If you want season tickets, you got to buy them to Nebraska because that's where they care about culture, and where they care about plogging. I mean, defense. And
go watch their practices.
And their practices. Oh, man, those practices.
Woo!
Bro hugs as you can.
Sub podding is my favorite kind of podding.
Hey, email has just come into the Dimeback inbox from Jimbo, who just says, comment. Hey, I just wanted to say no one cares about women's basketball. He has entered his email as notreal@AOL.com. The fact that he chose AOL, like that was the email he could think of, means he absolutely has an AOL account. And he's absolutely a fucking idiot. Jimbo, go crawl off in the woods and we'll find you in the spring.
Jimbo, it's okay. We all know you've never given a woman an orgasm.
Oh.
Can we keep all of this in the pot?
Yeah.